Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
He's a lycanthrope.
What's this?
Boils and ghouls, lock your doors and strap yourselves in. From Los Angeles, California, Bloody Disgusting presents the Boo Crew Podcast. Horror news, commentary, reviews, interviews, and more. With your hosts, Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio.
Why, hello there. My name is Trevor, and on behalf of myself, Lauren and Leo, welcome to your Boo Crew Podcast, episode 417, part of a creature double feature. If you're listening to this at time of release, thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us, by the way. The new movie is Blackout. It's in limited theaters and on VOD and digital now, and it's brought to you from horror filmmaking legend and Glass Eye Picks maestro Larry Fessenden, who joins us for a celebration of his work. He talks all about his incredible new werewolf flick and his reverence for the Universal Monsters. You're going to hear some wonderful Guillermo del Toro stories about his time working with him, the magic of radio dramas, some terrific inspirational words for indie filmmakers, and so much more. Larry is such a kind, talented, and endearing icon in the genre, and I know you're going to love this combo as much as I did. Just mute it whenever I talk. He's awesome. Me, not so much. All right. Episode 417 is now slaying.
Go ahead, scream. That's all we need.
Another victim crawls onto the gurney for a Boo Crew autopsy.
All right. Joining Bloody Disgusting's Boo Crew in the Speakeasy studio is an honest-to-goodness legend and perhaps the most impactful figure in independent horror filmmaking in our lifetime. He carved his way into NYU with Super 8 celluloid and videotape, where he created several features, including the first incarnation of his five-time award-winning classic, Habit, which he also starred in. By 85, he conceived Glass Eye Picks, and in doing so, a culture and community built on almost reckless innovation and fearless adventures and storytelling. He's to date been at the helm of almost 30 projects, among them three-time award-winning Wendigo, Depraved, and The Last Winter. His diversity as an actor is really overwhelming, from I Sell the Dead, You're Next, and Southbound, to We're Still Here, Jacob's Wife, and Martin Scorsese's 10-time Oscar-nominated Killers of the Flower Moon. But beyond all of that, if you can believe it, is his selfless commitment to nurturing and amplifying the voices of others, being there at the beginning to empower filmmakers such as Ty West, Mickey Keating, Anna Ascencio, Jen Wexler, and countless others. And doing so, continues to produce a run of the most extraordinary and influential films in the genre, from The House of the Devil, Psychopaths, The Innkeepers, The Ranger, and many more. Everything he does is unique, unforgettable, and absolutely unflinching in its vision, resourcefulness, and imagination. His newest film is a testament to all of that. A fine arts painter is convinced he's a werewolf that is terrorizing a small American town in Blackout. Your chance to experience it is on digital and VOD on April 12th at time of recording this Friday, and is being called one of the most intelligent and interesting werewolf movies of the 21st century. We are incredibly honored to welcome its director, Larry Fessenden.
Yes, sir.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to go because it's all downhill from there.
What are you talking about, man? This is awesome.
That is crazy.
Well, I mean, every word. And I mean, it's all so true. We are so lucky to have you out there fighting the good fight for all of us horror fans and for so long and continuing to do so every day. And we actually had the pleasure of speaking virtually I think a few years back for Jacob's Wife. It was a virtual campaign. It was yourself and Barbara and Bonnie. But thank you so much for making the time to come in person. It's a real thrill to actually meet you. So at different points in your career, you've shown us exciting explorations on the Universal Monsters, Frankenstein and Dracula, and now here with Wolfman. I would love to hear about your discovery of the Universal Monsters and what became your reverence for them?
Well, I always say I'm a typical child of my age because, you know, the famous thing is that they sold a package of the black and white movies to TV in the 50s or maybe the 60s. But in any case, I grew up watching those on TV. I lived in New York, and I couldn't wait for my parents to go play golf or something on a Saturday. And I would just kick back and I would watch. I mean, a lot of them weren't that good, but they're even memorable, like The Curse of the Faceless Man. I mean, oh my God, these movies, I haven't even revisited them. They live in my memory in a wonderful way. But, you know, The Crawling Eye, all kinds of weird stuff. But they had Frankenstein and Dracula, and those movies enchanted me, especially Frankenstein. I'm of the... You know, Dracula seemed a little more boring. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is I wanted the monsters right away. You know, I did it. And so the traditional thing of a art film or whatever they're called, an elevated horror is to, you know, hold off on the monsters.
Yeah,
so I was a very impatient child. Yeah. Now, as I grew up, I thought, you know, that maybe is more interesting. And the waiting is the best part and all of that. But so I just love the design of these creatures. And I think ultimately I really related to their outsider status. I love Karloff as the monster and the first Frankenstein. Everybody always says the second one is better. It felt more gothic and, you know, ornamental. I actually just love the spareness of the first Frankenstein. And then obviously I followed the series all the way to the bitter end with Abbott and Costello. Love the creature from the Black Lagoon. And I did love the Wolfman. And, you know, the cool thing is that the Wolfman story, which is sort of repetitive over the movies, but Lon Chaney was the one guy that kept coming back and doing that character. And even in the mashups like House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, he's always got sort of a fairly serious drama, you know, and then they sort of throw in Frankenstein and they always dispatch Dracula early on. I mean, they're very interesting in the way that they were trying to make that story, combining all the monsters. And, you know, it was probably kind of awkward. So that appeals to me. But, you know, this was my beginnings. And then I became aware of the Hammer films, of course. And, you know, it's funny. It's traditional that, you know, you're a cool guy. And so you're into the Hammer because they're tits and blood.
Yeah.
But actually, they never appealed to me in the same way. I didn't like the design of Christopher Lee, you know, as much. He was an awesome Dracula, maybe because I wasn't as fond of, of the Lugosi. And Lugosi only did Dracula twice. You know, of course, he... Anyway, and then Karloff was just a cool actor all along. So there was the Hammer movies. And then, you know, I grew up, there was a TV show called Frankenstein, The True Story. So, you know, all around these classic monsters, they were, you know, reinvented. And it was just started to be fun. Like, I guess, like a sports fan, you know, you're doing the... You're comparing, and how do you play this story? Of course, I did read the book, and it, you know, there's a great Stephen King introduction to Frankenstein, a particular edition where he goes, this is the most controversially disappointing book ever because most kids want to see the flat top and the whole monster with the bolts and the whole thing. But of course, it's an amazing text and it's such an incredible origin story that the greatest monster story ever written was by an 18-year-old chick. Beautiful, beautiful, in 1818. So all of the Mary Shelley stuff is fantastic. So blah, blah, blah. I mean, the other thing I often explain is that one night I settled down to watch a movie on TV, black and white. And, you know, it started nicely enough and spooky. And then there was a guy doing a Boris Karloff imitation. They're coming to get you, Barbara. And I watched this movie. And as it unfolded, it was like, this is so freaking bleak. This is different from those old movies. Mm-hmm. Something is happening to my brain. And, you know, what I'm describing, of course, is Night of the Living Dead. Yes, so this was my experience seeing that movie. I wish I could say I saw it in a drive-in or whatever, you know, the kids a little older than me might have done. But it blew my mind because it was so bleak and visceral. And this brought me, I think, into the new horror.
Yeah.
Bless George Romero. But I was a normal kid, grew up and liked, rock and roll and punk rock and new wave and Martin Scorsese and Robert Altman. And so I wanted to show my love of the classic monsters in a more contemporary way. And so that set me on this path, which I'm still forging this path of sort of reinventing or reimagining these classic stories, because I won't leave them behind. They meant so much to me, and I do believe they have resonance, but you need to, you know, spruce them up a little, bring them into the modern world. Even if I had all the money in the world, I don't think I'd be doing period piece versions of these. You know, as for example, Guillermo del Toro, he's definitely going to do a historic version for Frankenstein. Going to be great. Going to be cool. Look forward to that. But not my agenda.
Sure. Know? No, I get
like,
that.
I like saying, how are these relevant, these characters that, you know, they're almost like our Greek gods.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah, you know, and they have their own individual thing. Frankenstein's like, you know, why me? You know, why am I here? What's going, you know, who is my, where's my tribe? Wolfman, of course, you know, a divided personality, as is, you know, Jekyll and Hyde. That's another great old film. From 1932, but and then Dracula still has an appeal. I would say more vampires, although once again, you know, I love the Coppola Dracula. You know, that was sort of bananas.
Oh yeah, it was totally, awesome to experience. Yeah, totally a fever dream, right? Yeah,
absolutely, and that, you know, he's great in the sense that he's. I'm rooting for Franny. I mean, he's got his insane movie that he's working on now. I just every now and again, there's some mean spirited. Thing that like nobody's interested in this movie or it's gonna be terrible, and I'm just like, oh, let the dude, you know, come on. Yeah. Has he not done enough for us,
right? Seriously. What do you think it is about these monsters that make them such great avatars through which to ruminate on the human experience?
Nicely asked. I mean, well, first of all, Frankenstein the monster was designed by Jack Pierce, and that image, and then of course Karloff and his physicality. And then what he brought to the pathos. I mean, everybody feels like an outsider. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the prize kid in the school. Well, in fact, he's probably got his own problems.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I just feel like everyone can tap into that. Who are, you know, and then there's other themes in that. I'm not even sure Mary Shelley would, but she would be talking about parenthood. So there's the fatherhood. What is the obligation of the doctor to the monster? So you can mine that and so on. So there's that. And then you step over to Wolfman. He's got a curse. He can't, you know, he kills people at night and then he's remorseful in the day. You know, he also has a daddy issue in the original movie. But the point is I think this idea of being a werewolf, losing control, they're just, as you said, these are the archetypical descriptions of human nature. And then the vampire lusting forever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I don't know, the creature from the Black Lagoon is one of the most beautiful designs of a monster.
Oh, yeah.
But and then
also designed by a woman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Millicent.
Yeah.
I mean, there you just have the classic, you know, the nature kind of parable about, you know, we're disturbing nature. I mean, the creature was not violent until those two dudes showed up with
yeah,
the kick. You know, go figure. So that's a beautiful, you know, that's the classic. There's a whole, obviously, echo horror is a whole subgenre. And then there's Godzilla, and those dudes are cool. That whole family of monsters, and loved those as a kid as well. So, but they sort of signify something. It's one reason I'm not so fond of where the American series is taking us, because they're sort of getting into this mishmash with Monarch and all this.
Really about the spectacle, I think.
Yeah. But I mean, I actually like Garth Edwards' version, because the monster was just like this weird specter and you couldn't quite see it. I don't know, blah, blah, blah. It's cool. It's about the filmmakers. You can still revise these. And see what juice is left, you know?
Yeah. I particularly, I'm fond of actually terrified by the allegory of Wolfman and alcoholism. Uh-huh. Just because it's, you know, something I went through as a kid with a father who was, you know, your dad is the Wolfman in those cases.
Go. Absolutely.
There's nothing scarier than that.
Well, I use alcohol in a lot of my movies, because, you know, it's personal to my journey, and, I'm still on that journey. No, but I feel like, you know, that speaks of the weakness in the human animal, and as you say, it can manifest as rage or self-destruction or despair, you know, whatever. There's a whole gamut of the addicted personality. And I like to say that, unfortunately, you know, now we're all addicted. It's funny, the kids don't drink as much, which is, I'm sure, good for their health, but then they've got these other problems, which is social media driving them insane.
It's literally driving them insane.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating, talk about relevant horror
you know, I mean, obviously there are quite a few movies dealing with that. And, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, there'll be more because it is melting our brains.
Oh, yeah. And also, I mean, as far as young people growing up with it, what we're seeing, we've got four young kids.
Oh, shit.
The bullying, the body image issues. Yeah. I mean, it's endless. I can't even imagine. And I'm not that much, you know, I'm 47 years old. I grew up just at the cusp of, there was no internet when I was in high school. Sort of when I got into college, all of a sudden the internet was there. I can't imagine going through my teenage years having access to that, or with people who wanted to put me down having access to that.
Yeah, exactly. The vitriol. And we have it in all, you know, we blame the politicians, but it's everywhere. And it's just the worst of human nature being amplified. And that is just, that's a tragedy. In a weird way, I was making like emo horror.
Yeah.
You know, in the old days, you know, Sad Sam is the main character in Habit. He's drunk and, you know, so I was trying to tap into this idea of vulnerability and weakness and so on. So in that regard, well, I just feel for the kids because now every kid is sort of feeling that sort of, I wanted to reveal it and say, listen, we all feel this anxiety. But now it's really, it's the public conversation just, and I feel terrible because, you know, that's what I mean about monsters. Everybody feels like an outsider. And now that, as you say, the bullies are just weaponizing and the perverts. And I mean, you know,
it's
the whole thing. Wait, you don't even know who's coming at you.
It's kind of bringing out the worst in everybody, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's turning people who usually wouldn't be bullies into bullies because they have that shroud of anonymity.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. It's just disgraceful.
Yeah.
And then, and, you know, I don't know, people are making money off of this. So that's a tragedy. Yep. Another aspect of what's terrible about human nature. And then the politicians, you know, in pursuit of their own whatever, they've thrown away all the manner, you know, ethics and manners and whatever. It's just dog eat dog out there, and it's zero sum. This is another thing. Like, if somebody's doing well, then they're taking from you, and that's just a mindset. It's infected the entire culture.
It
and
really so has.
Just majorly fucked.
Do you think that all that said, and all that's going on, and the human experience as it exists today, is that why we are getting this resurgence of horror? I mean, it seems like there's a horror renaissance right now, and I wonder if it's because of all those things.
Yes, it's so obvious. And, you know, we lost David Scal, was a great writer of the history of horror. And he lays it out in a cool way, you know, just sort of tracks how horror has always been an expression of social anxieties.
Yeah.
Well, now social anxiety is just all over the news. You know, it's what it's the soup we swim in. What do we swim in soup? It's the, you know, and it's the the swill we swim in. Horror, you know, and also then horror is also getting more specific, kind of what I was saying, making emo horror, so to speak. Now, you know, there's queer horror and we're getting more representation. And so that, it's almost like different factions have their story to tell, you know, with Get Out and so on. Now this, so there's a lot more stories to tell, which is a good thing. I mean, I believe horror is an essential, maybe the essential genre.
Yeah.
I mean, we all like, well, maybe you might like a Western, not my favorite, but you know, there's that and there's action films, of course, but horror is really the psychology of the culture. Writ large. And, you know, but I always say not a documentary. It's more fun because you have to add the element of the imagination.
Yeah,
you have to create the monster. You have to, create the fantastic. And there you have imagination at play.
Yeah.
And the creativity becomes exciting. And how are you going to tell this story? I really believe, you know, metaphor is what we're talking about. We're celebrating the oldest literary technique of not speaking directly about something, but sort of, and in so doing, by creating a creature or something that represents an idea, it's a bigger tent. Everybody can feel like, oh, I feel like an outsider because I have these problems. But then you're like, but I can watch a movie about an outsider. And so I can have access to that. And so certain stories have meaning to different people for different reasons.
As a storyteller, you've not only created in the medium of film, you've done video games. And of course, it's this wonderful, it started as a, you were kind of ahead of the fiction podcast, what they know now as a fiction podcast, kind of like after the reluctant death of the radio drama around 2010, Tales from Beyond the Pale comes out. This project of exploring the medium of audio storytelling. And you were doing it in a way that really kind of like a lost art at the time. People hadn't jumped on that bandwagon yet, and you were kind of at the forerunner of that curve. What is it about telling stories in those other mediums that aren't film that is a little bit more challenging? Or how do you think in terms of narrative outside of the box of film?
So I invented the Tales from Beyond the Pale with Glenn McQuaid. Mm-hmm. He was a filmmaker, and we were driving upstate, and I have a young kid at that point, and I would tell the kids stories at night. And it became sort of my own little fetish, like, oh, I'm going to make up a story on the spot, you know? And yeah. So that was fun. And then I try to wrap it up and, you know, the kid be asleep or whatever. So I was really back in the mode of audio drama in my mind, and I would listen to them. And we were listening to like a Karloff audio drama from the olden days, because I'd play them for the kid in the back of the car. And then Glenn, of course, was like, this is fantastic. He said, you know, we should read Glass. I should do these. And I was like, done. So, then we called up all our friends who were writers and filmmakers, and we said, you have anything in a drawer that'll fit sort of a half hour format? And the main thing is, we said, don't restrict yourself to some sort of schlocky, old timey, you know, oh, so listen, the name is down the corner, see?
Right.
No.
The world is your oyster, right? If you want to drop a 3,000 pound cherry from a helicopter into a freaking chocolate, you do it.
We did space dramas with Ron Perlman and Doug Jones. Oh. We did one of them was about, what was it called? Confirmation. Anyway, about, you know, this guy who was cutting up this woman's face and making her more and more perfect. So the visuals are terrifying. And Simon Rumley wrote one that we had to label X. It was so appalling.
Well, so great.
So it was really cool. But the point is that, yeah, so we could do whatever we wanted because the budgets were whatever it took just to get into a studio with a couple of actors. And we really fetishized the sound design. When I was little, I would, this is before video. So I would record movies on audio tape and listen to them. Like, you know, I listen to Casablanca or something. And then I thought the FBI would come get me as I went into Jaws and I recorded it.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Exactly. Sneaking out with my bike, you know, riding down the back roads. So, and you know, the irony is I missed half of Quint's speech, you know, because I didn't flip the tape on time. So there you have it. So I only know half of the speech, but I know most of it, Mr. Hooper. So anyway, it's just this was my orientation. So and you know, people like Ty West and Graham Resnick, some of the Glass Eye troupe, they were always fetishized sound because, you know, sound is where you create the fear in a horror movie, especially if you're doing the quote slow burn vibe. Mm-hmm. You're going to, you know, not much is happening on screen, but you're hearing, you know, drones and whatever, the click clack of the heels on the floorboard. So anyway, we just naturally fell into it. And we did over the years about 50 of them. We started doing them live as well at film festivals. And the cool thing is we'd find out who was there supporting their movie and then invite them. So they'd rehearse once and then we'd go up that night. It was crazy.
That's cool. What did you do for the sound design element of that? Or would you just live read?
Foley, the classic.
Really?
We had dudes with, you know, the breaking the celery. Yeah. Don't hurt my arm. this kind of business and rain, you know. And then, to be honest, because it was so immersive and we also used real sound effects and sound design.
Yeah.
So it was a combo. But as far as seeing them live, we absolutely had people, you know, stabbing pumpkins and all of this good stuff. It was fun.
And then one of those stories was Blackout.
True that.
Right. And so tell us about coming up with the idea and kind of how it evolved from what was that 25-minute episode that where you played the title character into this full-blown feature.
Yeah. Well, I'd always wanted, you know, to do a werewolf film. It's funny. I was obsessed with this comic book from the 70s called Werewolf by Night.
Yeah.
And I went to Miramax in the 90s and I said, I want to do this property. I know we can, you know, and they said, aren't you some sort of outsider filmmaker? Why would you want to join the studio system? I'm like, I'm an outsider because you guys won't
right,
let me
the
in.
Hell, yeah. Stop gatekeeping. About? Exactly.
Yeah, you're freaking
you're doing exactly what you said you'd do.
Exactly. So I walked away, tail between legs. And, but, you know, I was scheming. And for whatever reason, I ended up making my Frankenstein movie. That took me 9 years, you know, just to get that made. I went to Hollywood and I pitched it to a lot of people. I had all kinds of angles on my Frankenstein, why it should be made. And some people, you know, I got meetings and but it just, I could see it falling through. So then the werewolf story was next. I pitched it for VHS, which is interesting because they tried to make it a found footage. I don't even know. I'll find that script and I'll put it on the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what I had done, but I did successfully. Anyway, they said no as well. And then, you know, it just kept percolating. So eventually I did it as a radio play because the way the radio plays work is like, suddenly you have a date. It's like in 2 weeks you have to have
exactly.
a script and a cast.
Yeah.
I was like, oh Christ. Oh, I'll just pull that thing out that I've been thinking about. And it is the same. It's part of the movie, the sort of the car crash. Now, the irony is that, of course, that's how crazy our radio plays were. Some of these most visual things that should be on film, we just do them with audio, and it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So the audience has to do the work.
Exactly. Bring it to life. I love that.
So that was fun. And then, long story short, but my son made a movie that I produced called Foxhole, and he found this actor named Alex Hurt, and I was the producer, so I'd be hanging out with the actors and chatting with everybody, and I found Alex to be very inspiring. He loves horror movies. That's why he became an actor, not his dad, but because he loved Boris Karloff.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, and he had a volatile relationship with his dad, and he was a drinker at one point. So the point is I just found him. He was the character. He was the Wolfman, you know, and the guy that I found to play Frankenstein, you know, he had this sort of stillness and this poise and this physique and this face. So he was my Frankenstein. You know, I'm finding these characters in real life and then I'm inviting them aboard. And So I invited Alex and Alex Hurt to be my werewolf. And he was so jazzed and he really committed to it. And he did the physique and,
God, he had like zero body fat.
Yeah,
that guy exactly. was a beautiful man.
It's true.
Was like, holy striking, man.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. Cause he, at first he bulked up. I didn't really have it that much of an opinion, but sure. I said, dude, be ripped. Don't give me, you know, whatever girth or whatever.
Yeah.
So, And the funny thing is his trainer was my Frankenstein because they're pals now because he was also in my son's movie, Alex Bro. So, you know, they worked out or whatever. He got him to drink like one thing a day.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know, green liquid.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I'm sipping, you know, bourbon in the corner.
Well, that like, shit, you know, man. Forget it.
Excuse me, Alex, a little flabby on the left there.
To understand it correctly, so the will and desire to do this picture was always kind of sitting in the back of your head, and it was meeting Alex that brought it back to the forefront for you, would you say, and go, oh, I got to make this movie now. I got my actor.
That's kind of how it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I'd have to really reflect, but the bottom line is I had to make a werewolf movie before I kicked, and it's getting close, so I got to get busy. So, you know, but as I say, you know, I sort of, people are always thinking like, you know, I don't sit down and write the thing and then make it. It's always percolating.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the time had come. After making Depraved, I started feeling like, I really like this thing of revising these stories. So I'll do it at least, let me at least do my trilogy with the werewolf. So anyway, but it was meeting Alex that was like, no time to lose.
Yeah.
And also, to be honest, I've become more realistic about, I'm not going to wait 9 years and fantasize that Hollywood wants an old guy like me. I mean, that's the other thing. To come in and do their shit. And you know, the other thing that motivated me is when I heard that Rai Rai was going to play Wolfman. I was like, fuck
yeah, right.
Fuck this. Now, weirdly, he's not doing it now.
Not
but
anymore.
They are
yeah.
shooting. And, you know, I am competitive, even though it's irrelevant. It's
For
only
sure.
in my own mind, but I got to beat these guys to the punch.
I told, you know, I was going to make The Orphanage with Guillermo del Toro. Wonderful, yes. Wonderful experience. We wrote the script.
Fassbender, what are you, like Agatha Christie? What is all this writing? So much writing.
That was Guillermo said?
Yeah, exactly.
No way.
Yeah, he's just teasing me all the time. Everybody ends up teasing me. I don't know what I got to kick me sign on my back. Martin Scorsese teased me on his set. Anyway, so Guillermo and I had a great time. We wrote this the script
also
together.
A huge Universal Monsters.
Oh, of course. Well,
worshipper.
That's kind of the point, is that eventually Orphanage fell apart because they couldn't get a mainstream actress to commit to me directing, or that was how they processed the problem. Although I had a great meeting with Kate Winslet in London. I flew to London. Oh. She was so great, and we had a fun time. And Guillermo had told me, Fassbender, wear your tooth. Come on, you're meeting a major actress. And I, you know, comb your hair, Fassbender. So I showed up in this London hotel. I'm all gussied up, and I got the tooth in and everything. And she walks in. She goes, wait, I thought you weren't going to have a tooth. She said, I do my research, so I just pulled it off.
That's amazing.
And we had a great time, and she committed to do it. We had a big hug, and we said, you know, well, this will be great. And she actually hooked me up with a lot of her, you know, people she admired, meaning her costume lady and her this and that. And yeah. That was already an amazing journey. Like 3 weeks later, I just heard from the, from her person, whatever that is, her rep.
Yeah.
She's going to go a different direction. The piece is too depressing, and she's died in the last two movies. Whatever the reason, that was how it came down. And at that point, the movie sort of unraveled. But my whole point is, so Guillermo said, but we got to do something right away. And I was like, oh my God. So I gave him my Frankenstein script.
Yeah.
I said, I'm ready to go. And he said, I'm not going to read that. I've got my own. So, you know, it was sweet.
But wow.
Now, a sharper mind would have gone and written another script, but I am a little obsessive. And long ago, I realized that having six scripts in the drawer, this is not probably good advice, but this is my experience. Just having six things, you're not pitching one of them with the intense passion and
right.
focus
like
that
do
it
or
takes
die. This
to
is
make
everything.
The
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I got this. I got a Western. I got a, you know, I keep talking about Westerns. I don't watch Westerns, but it's the classic genre. I mean, you know, I got a comedy, I got a this or that, I got a monster picture and zombies. What do you want? What do you want? It it hadn't worked for me. I had to commit to something. So I did commit to Depraved, and it was kind of like a long haul. And the irony is I have other unproduced scripts, but this is how I got Depraved made. And it didn't happen the way, you know, it wasn't the bigger movie. But I was very happy where it landed. And then that's sort of why, this is all to say why I made the Wolfman movie, because I just now, as I say, I'm getting older, and I've schooled kids for decades in just do it. Stop worrying about the money. And, you know, I get reviews that talk about like, well, it's clearly on the low budget is why he did this and that. It's like, actually, no, I never let the budget truly restrict the vision. I mean, clearly you can't do some things, but, you know, they're like, oh, it's a flat face werewolf because he couldn't afford the Rick Baker look makeup. Or I'm like, no, that's not why it's flat face. It's because I like Werewolf by Night and Lon Chaney, you know. Yeah. So this is all I'm saying. I try not to, you know, we've made movies about spaceships and robots and everything. I had no money. It's you figure out the approach. So that's what I've told the kids over the years. And now I have to take my own medicine.
Sure.
The Boo Crew will be right back.
He's a lycanthrope.
What's that?
A man who imagines himself to be a wolf.
This is no imaginary wolfman. It's Lon Chaney Jr. as the real thing.
There's a curse upon me. I change into a wolf.
I know a man who has the power to help you.
Frankenstein? Don't mention that name around this town.
Dr. Frankenstein left a diary. In it are his records of the secrets of life and death.
My father was a great scientist. But all he created brought unhappiness.
Unhappiness and a legendary monster. Lon Chaney Jr. and Bela Lugosi battle for the heavyweight championship of horror when Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Yeah. As far as getting into the story yourself and coming up with the concept for this movie and writing the story, what were some of the first, was there a gateway image or scene or line that you had in mind that was your gateway into the story? First thing you kind of came up with?
Yeah, and I'd say it's in the radio play. It's right. The idea of turning into a werewolf when you're driving.
Yes. Which is a very super, that's an extraordinarily unique transformation sequence that yeah. I've never seen before.
It's definitely not in a movie. I think there's a image of something like that in Werewolf by Night. I don't know which issue, but I discussed it with Glenn once that he's like, you know. So I just wanted to see that. And it speaks to the sort of, it's sort of, I just like monsters in the everyday world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he gets held up, you know, because he's filling the car with gas. And so he misses his moment. He's trying to get to his friend's house. And he's like, all right, I'm going to do a special favor because he's going to trade in his car for the silver bullet.
Yes,
whatever.
Yes,
and
yes.
So it's just, and also it's just like the little thing. You know, what I love about Spielberg's, some of his death scenes is just when, you know, this, or actually it's the Night of the Living Dead, when the sweater gets stuck and you're like, you're everything, you're just a little thing,
yeah, little
can be your
moment.
Undoing,
yeah,
and you're done. So it's that kind of idea, like, oh, dazed, you know, the timing just went wrong, and so that's why he turns into a werewolf. And then, you know, it leads to one thing and the next. But so that was, I suppose, the central, just a special image. And
yeah.
then, you know, once again, themes of alcoholism, because it's called Blackout, because, you know, if you really can't remember, that is a strange reality. I mean, you think of death as just a blackout that keeps lasting. So, you know, whatever, there's something about consciousness versus, you know, and memory. And then the movie is obviously about other things in terms of regret. And he's trying to put his house in order because it's a movie about suicide, really, yeah. which is just sort of also. And yet, who wants to watch a suicide movie? But if it's a werewolf movie, maybe it'll be fun. You
exactly.
know, that's the hope. So all of that.
What having that scene is kind of your benchmark gateway into it when it came to actually filming it. How did you kind of get around actually making it work so beautifully?
That's the funnest thing about movies. Yeah. You just figure it out. And, you know, we did some things on a, I don't think we ever, we might have towed the car one time. So, sure. So you tow the car, then you do what's called poor man processing, where you're just like jiggling it and, you know, and you just sort of build it. I mean, this is why I like making movies. It's not because I want to meet agents.
Sure.
It's because, you know, you just figure out how to tell that story.
Right. And actually, how to synthesize the reality
yeah,
of it all.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And, you know, what is the build of the build of it? And then, you know, obviously what we did is we applied the makeup in stages. So, you know, it's all of that. It's just fun. It's like a beautiful puzzle that you have to figure out.
Yeah.
And then, well, we had to flip the car, and that was harder than you think because you need a hill that feels steep. But then as soon as it's too steep, they put a railing and you're like, I can't even, you know, finding the location was much harder than you'd think.
Sure.
And,
sure.
you know, my compatriot, Chris Ingvardson, he's like a stunt guy and made badass indie movies in the old days in film. And, you know, he would have stunts and cars and everything. So he imagined it going off a cliff. And I was like, no, I don't want that. I just want something that's like, wah, wah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm much more into like, not the sensational thing where it turns into a spectacle. And that, I mean, see, I think a lot of people would see that and go, oh, we didn't have the budget. But no, it's not. I didn't want it to go off a cliff. I wanted it to just kind of, you know, because this is the point. It's like if you made your dog drive the car, it wouldn't be some spectacular.
Right, exactly.
It would just be like,
yeah. It'd be messy.
Yeah, it would be messy. I'm more interested in the messy and, the, yeah. you know, whatever. Everything is just so in a weird way, my budgets suit my aesthetic, which is just. Everything's a little ragged, like, you know, pub rock, or everything's a little more tactile and just kind of messy.
It gives it that such a creepy feel and experience. Like, I got to say, some of my favorite scenes are when he's just kind of walking and running across the in the forest or in a dark field. And the way he moved, was that carefully constructed? Was that something he worked on and went away and kind of showed
oh,
you
yeah.
what he was going to do?
Well, it's funny, you know, his mother is a dancer, so he had gone to dancing school when he was young, or, you know, I'm saying serious shit, ballet and
yeah.
stuff.
And but more to the point is that, once again, back to Werewolf by Night, if you look at the pictures, they're very angular poses that suggest the movement and then the monster sort of landing in a pose.
Yeah,
and
I mean, very iconic.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I do that shit all ever since I was a little kid, I would make those moves. And so in a way, to translate to Alex, I said, well, let's think of this as Bob Fosse, because he's also very angular. I mean, whatever, and we would joke like, don't give me jazz hands.
Right.
He's off from the jazz hands. So we would have some jazz hand issues and we'd just back off a little. But ultimately, I really liked the work that he did. And he worked with a composer, a choreographer, advisor, friend, and, they had fun. And I think he really came to own this, which was very specific. I mean, I have videos that I sent him of me running around the yard, and I hate looking at them because I'm like, really, I did get old, people thought I would play the werewolf, but I mean, I just, it would, what a nightmare. And look how good Alex looks. So that's better for film.
There's something in his eyes too. It's so brooding and he looks so sad and tragic, just, as the character Charlie. He just sucks you right into the story instantly.
I mean, I think it's common knowledge that then his father died while we were, right in pre-production. And so he really brought a great deal of personal baggage to the movie. And as I say, he had been a drinker. And so he knew that. And this is why I cast him, because I felt there was a melancholy to him. He's a beautiful guy and a committed artist. But, just hanging on, which is what the kind of characters that I want to portray.
Yeah.
I would make a story about a hero, but I would show his flaws.
Yeah.
If such a story was to be told. And in it's a way of inviting the audience to relate to a character. Like, I don't want to make, I mean, I think that's a trope now. Even the superheroes have flaws. I mean, that's just the place we're in as a culture. We're sort of trying to peel back the mythology. So in that regard, I think what I'm doing is in sync with in a way, I feel like some of my movies were anticipating what was to come in terms of horror becoming more personal and allowing it to be more personal. I mean, I'm not saying anybody was paying attention to me, but I think that's the arc we're on.
Yeah.
So be it.
Yeah.
Alex was so key, and the movement was, but I like what you're saying, because there are just scenes where the monster's running.
Yeah.
And I have no agenda. I want you to think about, what it would be like to be an animal. We're calling him a wolf man and we know he's going to kill people, but that's only because he encounters them. Another thing in the movie that's kind of funny is that he doesn't kill all the people that get killed. It's some other happenstance. In a way, he just creates a sense of chaos, because obviously he's a werewolf and everybody's like, what the fuck? But he's not a vicious thing. He's a wild thing.
Yeah. There's a scene I wanted to ask about that I just loved. He's kind of coming through a doorway. It's completely dark and your left's kind of staring at it for a while, wondering what's going to happen.
Nice.
The way he emerges is just beautiful. Was that something you had conceived before? Do you storyboard that, or is that something you just day of, like, let's try this?
No, everything is the way I work is I don't really storyboard unless it's, a stunt or whatever.
Yeah.
But I make very particular shotless.
Sure.
And I'm just like, we're going to do this, and this, and this. And then, obviously the DP, everybody starts contributing. But I map it out, because it's about the pacing of the scene and, the build of the scene. I always say that Hitchcock would observe that film is about how you reveal information. So you don't always put the wide shot in the beginning, because that's not the point of the scene at first. Maybe you show the soup close up and then the guy's face and you go, oh, he's hungry. And then the question is, he's hungry, but where? Then you get your wide shot. So you don't just throw stuff away like in the old TV shows. They just show the outside of the Odd Couple's house.
Yeah.
And then so to orient you, but you're not always trying to orient the audience. Anyway, so that's the thing. I just cut to a door and you're like, okay, so what's going on? And then he emerges. And what I would say, not to give the whole thing away, but he's realized that this quote curse is a weapon. And that's sort of the final chapter is he like, the first part of the movie, he's trying to kill himself and just be done with it all. And he's sort of trying to fix this and that, but he keeps fucking that up because he doesn't get to the friend's house and so on. And then other things go wrong. So the last chapter, and that's kind of the beginning of it, is, I wanted to suggest, he's made a decision. Mm. And he knows that, you know, oh, in 45 minutes, I'm going to be, you know, a real problem for somebody who's in my close proximity. And so he decides who that guy's going to be. And that's sort of the vibe. So I love that you mentioned that shot. Of course, it's on the poster.
No, I love it. And I'm curious about this. What did you enjoy? I mean, I love watching it as a viewer because it was really refreshing. But what did you enjoy playing with the dichotomy of werewolf by night, painter, fine artist by day, and these white pants that he wears?
Yeah.
That shows, it shows his art, right? It shows paint stains, it shows blood stains.
That's what I love.
Right?
And there's some review. I mean, this was long ago, but I just had to smile. They're like, what is this shit? He's got blood stains all over. I'm like, no, that's not how a normal, if you see that guy in the street, you're like, oh, he must be a painter. Yeah. And then, of course, the other dude makes fun of it and he's wearing a pink shirt. So there's the pants play for different reasons. Mm. And also, you're going to have a brown werewolf because he's got his fur or whatever ends up, whatever we ended up with. It seems so striking to have the pants white. Yeah. So, and, you know, that's the classic painter's pants. So blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I mean, these are the fun things. You just realize that's what it's going to be. Same with the car. Had to be a white Volvo. I mean, I set my whole team off to find me a white Volvo. I didn't want a red Volvo. I didn't want a blue Volvo because that's a whole other thing. I mean, you can ask, why is it white? I'm not going to get into that, but you just have the vision and you need to pursue that. I always care about the color of cars. It's weird. Like in movies, whatever it's going to be, it has to be.
Oh, so. That's interesting. I bet subconsciously as a viewer, it probably.
Well, it does whatever. World of things. And, obviously, it's blank canvas, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you're going to also see the blood in if that's the situation. But everything about the, you know, that's the fun thing about making a movie. For example, wolves don't see red and green. Isn't that crazy?
Mm, wow.
So every shirt in the movie is blue.
Oh, wow.
Or yellow, because they see blue and yellow. So it's just little things like that. And you tell that to your team and you're like, all of a sudden, why are you giving me this red shirt that's just not going to play?
Yeah.
Also, then you're holding off for the blood. When it happens.
Right.
So this is the pleasure of making a movie. You're building an entire world. And there's some, you know, I don't believe there's one meaning that I'm conveying to the audience. And if they crack the code, they'll know what my movie is. Mm-hmm. But you're building a series of connections and thematic ideas. For example, you know, the movie's perceived as political or whatever, because it's about a divided town. But my point is, it's about a divided person who's a werewolf at night and a dude in the day. So I start with that. That's the monster. And then I'm like, so what does that remind me of? Well, our towns are divided now. The nation is. So it's going to start to absorb some of the contemporary problems we're having.
Yeah.
And also the blame game. There's a werewolf out killing people. But wouldn't it be convenient to blame someone else for that problem, which is another thing we tend to do in our society nowadays. Mm-hmm. And everybody's finger pointing and everybody doesn't understand the other person's reality. So I wanted to bring that into this story and just show that chaos is everywhere. And, you know, that's what's, and so the werewolf is just a catalyst for everybody. Oh, now we're really upset.
Right.
Which is sort of the way we seem to be absorbing problems now. I mean, so it's also a movie that's angry about the silliness of humanity. You know, why are we doing this to ourselves when we have presumably intelligence to make real decisions and get to the bottom of something and then maybe fix it or try to agree? Anyway, all of that. And so those things were motivating me. But also, I wanted him to be a painter. You had asked that, I think, because he's already outside of society. Mm. He's just seeing the world in a certain way. And he starts out by painting. I don't know how clear this is, but you could track it. He starts painting just environmental paintings, trees and this and that and beetles or whatever he's doing. But then as his mind, as his world darkens, then he starts painting self-portraits and sort of becomes more and more obsessed with his self. And then sort of these blurry portraits like a Francis Bacon kind of, you know, distorted. And you realize, you know, he's becoming narcissistic and self-involved and psychologically damaged. So I'm suggesting, or in any case, I like that flow because that's what's happened to humanity to some degree. We've just become more and more navel-gazing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is, how I build a movie. It works for some people, not for others. I understand how it is, but that's what I'm contributing is sort of the other things that are on my mind and trying to bring them into the horror world. And it's the idea of like living with the fact that you're a werewolf. It's sort of like what we all live with. In other words, there's always death floating around, and there's a certain amount of guilt or concern or fear. Those elements are always with us. And so that's where the metaphor of the werewolf sort of is the thing on your shoulder, you know? So
going back to what we talked about earlier a bit with sound, I wanted to reference this because I find it spectacular, as spectacular as it looks to watch and immerse yourself in the beauty of all these visuals, is that you could really not like close your eyes and just listen to this movie, and it plays beautifully. And I will say that the voices of who you cast, people like Addison Timlin, there's poetry in a lot of these lines, and the way they are said really invokes really rich imagery. And I'm wondering if there's something that you inherently look for in the human voice when you're casting that maybe you don't even think about outside of performance. Is there something in the voice that you gravitate towards?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I do think Alex has a cool voice.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, I don't use voiceover like Taxi Driver, but I do somehow find myself with voices. In this case, he's been writing a series of letters to his girlfriend because one of the things he's leaving behind is an explanation. The reason I got weird is I was a werewolf. So, you know, he wants forgiveness. So it's fun. If you were to look at it, you'd realize the timing is weird. Like he's saying, well, I'm going to Earl's now, when it's way later in the movie, and you realize we're hearing a letter that he had written previously, and we know what happens when he went to Earl's. So we're sort of like ahead of it going, oh shit, you thought things were going to end there, and it didn't end there anyway. But so he has a beautiful voice. And I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm a radio guy, and maybe that's in my thinking, but I think I'm choosing actors because of their wonderful sort of naturalism and their ability to understand, look, we're trying to do this naturally, but my writing is a tiny bit stilted, which I mean is, I don't know, it's both just my nature, but also I'm not uncomfortable people saying things that are just a little bit outside of every day, because I am interested in these other types of themes. So somebody might say something that you're like, oh, well, that makes me think of this, you know, so whatever, I don't know. But I think that Rigo Garay, he plays Miguel. He's got a beautiful quality, a lilt in his voice.
Yeah.
Joe Swanberg is a hoot as his character. So there were three people that went outside the script. Joe sort of, he's very funny. He just shows up and he's like, well, I got this.
That's awesome. And he just kind of does whatever.
Which is, and you know, in a way, he just deepened and also made far more nuanced and smarmy his character, because he's sort of trying to be, you know, the most modern man listening to the problems of his girl. But you could just see he's like clutching his glass, getting more and more frustrated. And then he's like, okay. So his thing was beautiful. And I almost use it as a oneer just to say, look at Joe just spread his wings.
I love that scene with him and her in the kitchen.
Yeah, kind of great. Yeah. And she's, you know, always amazing. Oh, it's just, in fact, she's the only person who's in but both movies as a totally different character. So whatever, that's fun. But Kevin Corrigan brings always something completely random. And, you know, I just like surprises in this, what at first would appear like naturalism, but actually there's all this kind of slightly Baroque weird shit going on.
Sure.
Oh, well, I know the two goons.
Oh, yes.
Those guys.
They were drunk and I'll be with you wherever I got you back kind of thing.
Exactly.
I love that.
I got your back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was the main theme that I wanted from them. Just the idea of sort of two dudes promising, you know, to hang forever.
Yeah.
And then you kind of realize at the end, just very small talk about microaggression. You know, the other guy just abandons him. You know, Mark Center is just left there going, wait, what? Remember you said all that thing? But then they came up with the whole idea that the recording, which is just so ridiculous. In the modern day, they'd use cell phones or something, but instead they, you know, they bought this little recording thing. So So I'm just saying, so Swanberg and then Cody, and Mark, those are the people that kind of started riffing a little bit more.
Yeah.
But then you have fucking Corrigan. There's a moment when he leans down and he comes back up. And you think he's picked up a cat because he's like,
kitty, kitty, kitty.
Right. And when he rises back into frame, there's nothing there. And he's just patting. And you're like, oh, my God, that's going to be in the movie. I don't know good. I think it was take 7 and he was getting bored. And it was like, oh, my God, I should have, you know, this is fantastic.
That's in the Churchill speech. Was that in the script? That was in the script.
I love that.
Well, see, but that's the thing. I wanted you to meet these people briefly and yet somehow get a sense of their backstory. And I picture that guy, he's like, things aren't the way they used to be. So he's just some old grumpy white guy. And you figure he probably watches the History Channel. And he knows all about World War II.
Yes.
You know, the good old days. And he's watched the Churchill documentary. So he's like, you know, quoting Churchill. Unexpected in a, you know, a rural setting, you know, whatever. I don't know what his job is. But he, anyway, I just think that's so random. And yet, you know, I knew friends like that who would watch the History Channel constantly.
And it comes out in their daily speech.
Whatever.
Would you say that, going back to the poetry of the lines, because I really think there is, I mean, I even wrote some of them down that I remember, like, that's not trauma, those are just my circumstances. It's a beautiful liner. Stop punching at the world. There are a lot of them in there. Are these things that you keep in a journal as you're writing and come up with things on the day-to-day, or does the story as you're going through inspire that poetry?
That's beautiful. I mean, I really appreciate that. So the trauma line is something that I believe, you know, now in the modern world, everyone has their trauma. And you're like, I thought that was just growing up, which is back to like where this all started, you know, feeling alienated. I feel like I'm Frankenstein's monster. I don't know where I am, you know, but that's how I thought, you know, I have body dysmorphia. Everybody feels fat or thin or, you know, short or tall. It's like, and I'm not diminishing where that has, you know, and as you say, now we have bullying. In other words, it's become a coarser society. There's no doubt. But I'm just, I think also it's a form of denialism. So you could read it both ways. He's also saying, I had a terrible time. My dad was terrible to me, but it wasn't trauma. You know, that's certainly, I would think alcoholics are always saying, everything's fine.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's fine. Can I just get another denial. One of these, please?
Yeah.
So there's denial, which was the original title for habit.
Oh.
You know, I was like, what are the different things that alcoholics do? Well, they just habitually have just one more.
Exactly.
And denial is, of course, the master plan of any addict. So, and the other line, punching at the world, it just appealed to me. So I don't really keep journals, or if I do, I rarely go back to them, but I'll write to try to preserve an idea. But the real thing is that I'm, I just sort of live with it over and over. It's kind of like, remember, I also act. So I just constantly trying to sort of be in the head of these different characters.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wish I could say I had a process. I always say I'm a magpie. I just find things that, images or moments that appeal to me, and then I sort of say, they're talking to me. So
yeah.
They want to be in this movie.
Exactly.
So let me figure out, because in a way I'm an editor more than anything. Just like, I mean, I don't have to tell you. I actually, more than anything, just love environments. And like, I'll like, you know, oh, I have all my little toys and I'll arrange them such a way. And I build desks and you know, I build furniture and just, and so I always say that that's the same thing as cooking. You're really just organizing things like, oh,
right.
I'm going to have this over here.
Right.
I'm going to have my overstuffed chair there, and that's going to be perfect.
Right. The ingredients all exist.
All the ingredients.
How you
I like
play
to
with
cook
it.
Also. So I think all of these things are about gathering materials or you know, ingredients, and then seeing what you come out with. And then, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm preoccupied with various thematic things because I'm always imagining how would the world be a better place? How would we organize it? Speaking of organizing,
sure.
Like what should we be doing? I mean, we all know the fucking clatter out there, the babble, but you know, it's one thing to just say everybody's an asshole, but what would you hope to do if you were running the world? And the irony is, well, the closest you come is run a set.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
You know, because I do believe there's only one boss on a set.
Yeah.
And so are they a good rule? You know, do you rule by fear or by love? Those are, I love these kind of questions. Mm. Like, you'd find that line in my movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of cheesy, but I like stating the obvious. That's another thing. As my kid, I'll always state the obvious, because I think sometimes we just forget some of the little nuggets that are worth repeating, you know.
Well so. Said, man. Well said. All right. It's come to the end of our time here, unfortunately, but I wanted to go with one last question. And I think this is an important one for a lot of filmmakers that are listening. So much about independent cinema and the access to content has changed exponentially in such a short time to an almost dizzying effect, I would say. How do you kind of perceive the evolution of indie filmmaking, and what advice would you give to any aspiring filmmakers kind of navigating the landscape as it exists now?
Well, first of all, you got to be doing it for the love of the work. You know, if you're doing it to become famous, that's just sort of it seems like a fool's errand. Now, I'm wishing everybody well, and I hope they do find success, obviously monetary as well as accolades. But the bottom line is, you have to do it because you want to and you love telling stories. And I would say, speaking truthfully rather than anticipating a result, if you say something from the heart in your work, that is unique, and there's no budget that can take that away from you, you know. So you have something specific to offer that Hollywood can't create. So, you know, work from your internal passions, whatever they are, and whatever matters to you. Maybe it's your identity. Maybe it's a thematic thing. Maybe it's a kind of werewolf. Maybe it's a kind of image, you know, a dark night. Oh, I just imagined this spooky house that I grew up in when I was little, or, you know, that I visited. So all of that, make it personal, and then you can speak with complete authority about it. You know, if you're just imitating another movie or something, well, you know, are you going to do it as well? But if you are trying to access something personal, so there's all of that. Distribution is really tough. That's kind of where you're going to get boned, because they don't really give MGs anymore, not in the same way. MG is a minimum guarantee, and that's when in the old days you'd sell your movie for $300,000 that you made for $250,000, or I don't know. The numbers were crazy in the old days. You'd sell a movie at Sundance for a couple $1 million that you might have made for $700,000. It happens to some people, but we can't think those are the real stories. Those are the nice, exceptional stories. Yeah. So there's, I always say, build a community of people that will come to your movie and then help them make their movies. You know, this is sort of what Glass Eye ended up doing. I mean, I self-distributed Habit because nobody would buy it. And that's sort of, I took that to heart. And then I would always distribute the movies we made. Ty West's first movie was called The Roost. And we put it in theaters. I mean, you know, just a couple theaters, and then it did sell. We doubled our money. So that was incredible. But the point is that that isn't going to happen every time. But we built a community of people. And now, I mean, that was then. We did it our way with things like postcards. But now you have the internet. Get a YouTube channel. Show your movies on YouTube. There's some stories of people who've made feature films.
For sure.
When they've been discovered with shorts on YouTube. So I had this thing called public access. We would make tapes every week and give them to the, you know, the cable company, and it would be on public access TV. So, you know, we were making content that you could switch from NBC to our channel at 11 o'clock on Tuesday night. So you have to be inventive, and you have to, unfortunately, stay ahead of this, because it's exhausting at my age to still be reinventing the distribution model. But that's a thing. So what have I said? Do it personally. Don't wait around for the money. I mean, look, at least make your first movie, maybe even your first and second movie, cheaply. You can shoot it on an iPhone. I know that's a cliche, and there's great equipment now that you can access, and there are great lights and great sound equipment. So, you know, you can make a movie fairly cheaply. All the more reason to do something that's going to matter and that you're proud of. 10 years from now, it's relevant to something because it's personal, or it's, you know, doesn't mean some sad sack thing. It can have monsters and demons and ghosts and all that, but let's have it connect to something that people can care about, you know. Mm-hmm. So those are some ideas. I don't know, dude.
Dude, I gotta say thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for taking the time to do this, and just for everything that you're out there continuing to do for this amazing genre. It's the best genre in the world. And
yeah,
you're just, you've always been at the forefront of it, and it just means everything to us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, dude. And I'm telling you, I'm going to take that clip of your introduction. I'm going to give it to my mother.
It's all yours, man. It's all yours. All right. So you're listening Blackouts on VOD and on demand as of April 12th. And until we meet again, man, it's just been amazing.
It's been a real pleasure, dude. Thanks so much.
And that, as they say, was your Boo Crew Podcast, episode 417. Special thanks to our guest, Larry Fessenden. At time of release, Blackout is in limited theaters and on VOD and digital now. Production track for this one provided by the good folks at Powerman 5000. Till next time, from myself, Lauren and Leo, it is the Boo Crew saying, sweet screams.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Boo Crew Podcast. Haunt the Boo Crew at TalesFromTheBooCrew.com. Tales from the Boo Crew on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on Twitter at Tales from the Boo. The Boo Crew is Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio. The Boo Crew is produced by Lauren Shand, chopped and sliced by Trevor Shand. The Boo Crew is a TSP creation, part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Bye.
A Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, home of the Boo Crew, horror-centric interviews, SCP archives, weekly full cast storytelling, horror queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and creepy for disturbing and terrifying creepypastas. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.